Now, Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. Now, here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest is the governor of Ohio, Mr. Michael DeSalle. This is the third in our series of interviews with leading American governors. Ohio has long had a role of importance in the nomination and election of presidents. Ohio has sent more presidents to the White House than any other state except Virginia. Governor DeSalle is certain to have great influence in the 1960 Democratic Convention. At the present moment, there is much speculation over whether Governor DeSalle and Senator John Kennedy will be opponents in the Ohio presidential primary. Governor DeSalle began his public career 25 years ago. He has served in the Ohio legislature and as mayor of Toledo. He was the first chairman of the Citizens Committee, which put into operation the so-called Toledo Plan for dealing with labor disputes. It has been widely copied. Governor DeSalle entered the national scene in 1950 as the federal director of price stabilization. In that position, he encountered many of the problems of inflation that are confronting the country today. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Governor DeSalle, are Ernest K. Lindley of Newsweek magazine, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Governor DeSalle, if you're ready, sir, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Governor, as you know, there have been many reports that you would like to have Senator Kennedy stay out of the Ohio primaries because you want to go to the convention as the favorite son of Ohio. Is that or is that not true?
Well, there have been many reports. I've read them myself. So I know that when you say that there have been reports, that that's true. Senator Kennedy will be in Ohio on September the 15th, and I expect to talk to him at that time. Maybe shortly after that, there will be some decisions made.
Well, now, are you yourself planning at this time to enter the Ohio primary?
No, I am not planning at this time. You see, in Ohio, we filed in February of 1960. I've seen no urgency in declaring a candidacy.
Do you think that the leading Democratic candidates for the presidency ought to compete in Ohio?
Well, if this was to be a national affair and we were going to compete in the 48 states, I would say that Ohio certainly shouldn't be left out.
Well, does that mean then that you really don't believe in the primaries as they are now constituted?
The primaries as they now are constituted actually have never really produced any binding results on the convention. For example, in 1952... Governor Stevenson did not enter a single primary and wound up with the Democratic nomination.
Well, does that mean, then, that you don't really think the primaries are worthwhile?
Well, I think primaries in major offices within the state where people have an opportunity of knowing the candidates certainly have been worthwhile.
Now, Governor, I've known you for many years, and you know exactly what's going to happen in Ohio, I'm sure. Are you or are you not planning to run as favorite?
Well, I wish I knew what was going to happen in Ohio. I don't know what's going to happen in Ohio tomorrow, really. I'm making a Labor Day speech in Barberton. I'm not sure whether I'll get out of Barberton.
Well, may I change the question, and what would you like to happen in Ohio? Would you like to see Senator Kennedy enter as a candidate?
Well, I'll discuss that with Senator Kennedy in September the 15th, 1959. We'll discuss it.
Mr. Drummond.
Governor DeSalle, you mentioned that you thought that primaries were useful for selecting statewide offices. Does that mean that from the standpoint of the selection of presidential candidates, you rather have a dim view?
I do. I think the convention system has worked out well, and I prefer the convention system.
Right.
In fact, I even prefer the convention system in state office in the nomination of candidates for minor office, where people do not have the same interests as they do in major offices.
As you have indicated, this program offers a good opportunity to clear up conflicting political reports, and I've read reports that your real sympathies and support are for the nomination of Senator Simonton. Is that...
I've also read those reports. None of these reports really have any foundation. I've never discussed Senator Simonton's candidacy with Senator Simonton or anyone primarily interested in Senator Simonton, nor have I discussed Senator Kennedy's candidacy with anyone else.
You're saying you haven't made up your mind or don't want to tell us anyway?
No, I have not made up my mind. I think it's early, and possibly I'm in a position which may not be unusual. But in 1950 and 51, I was in Washington, early part of 52, and came back for a while in the latter part. I worked with these fellows, Senator Kennedy, Senator Simonton, and the other candidates, Senator Humphrey, Senator Johnson. Know all of them personally, and I have a great deal of respect for all of them. I have a feeling that this decision is going to be a difficult one. And I'd like to have the opportunity of consulting with other leaders throughout the country as to what will best serve the nation as well as best serve the party. And as of today, I have not discussed the presidential aspirations of any candidate with any other governor or with any other Democratic leader in the country.
Mrs. Craig.
Governor, when Mr. Kennedy visited you there in July, did you make an agreement that you would meet again in the fall before either one of you made an announcement? And is that what you're going to talk about when he comes out later this month?
When he was there, that is exactly what we agreed to do. We agreed that we would talk again later in September or October or even later. Both of us agreed that the time was very, very early.
Yes.
Senator Kennedy said publicly, as he said privately, that he had not decided yet whether he would announce his candidacy for president. And certainly he would not announce a candidacy as far as Ohio was concerned until he had made a decision on his overall candidacy.
Did he convey to you then that either you'd be pledged to him or that he'd run against you in primary?
No, he did not. Senator Kennedy is a very diplomatic gentleman. He's been in Congress, he's been in the Senate, and he's a gentleman. I don't think that anyone would approach me that way.
Yes. Do you know whether Senator Lauschy would like to be the favorite son and control the delegation?
I have not discussed it with him at all.
Do you plan to?
I would like to. I think that he's among the Ohio leaders and among the national leaders.
Will you see
him while you're
here?
He is not in town today, as far as I know.
Yes. He helped you considerably. Would you run against him for the Senate in 62?
As I told Larry, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow, let alone 62.
Yes.
We have an intervening election in 60.
Yes. You threw your strength against Kennedy and for Kefauver for vice president. Do you have any prejudice against Senator Kennedy, or you less favor him than anybody else?
No, not at all. Actually, in 1956, the decision was made on the basis of Senator Kennedy's age and the fact that Senator Kefauver had campaigned throughout the country and had a great deal of support. And I felt that he was entitled to the chance to be on the national ticket. In fact, on the day of that nomination, I talked to Senator Kennedy. We were the last two to leave the convention hall, and I told Senator Kennedy at that time, I said, as a result of today's action, you are alive politically. You'll be alive in 60, you'll be alive in 64. If you should have been nominated for vice president today and have been defeated in 56, the chances are that you would have had to accept the blame for the defeat and consequently would have been through as far as national aspirations were concerned.
Well, Governor, if you have vice presidential ambitions yourself, being a Catholic, it would be very bad to have the Catholic Senator Kennedy get the presidential nomination, wouldn't it?
Well, Mrs. Craig, let me tell you right now that I do not have vice presidential aspirations, although I suppose if I was to be a candidate for anything, I would be a candidate for vice president instead of president. I've just been informed that every successful nominee for the presidency in a year ending in zero since 1840, was either assassinated or died in office. So that actually the vice presidency this year might have some new significance.
Mr. Lindley.
Governor, all of these Democratic candidates for the presidency, past and present, you've mentioned, are senators. Do you think the nominee will come from the Senate?
Well, Mr. Lindley, I don't place geography or background, political background, as a qualification for office. I think that the man who's nominated will be the man who will appeal to the delegates in July of 1960 as the man who can best lead the nation and who has the best chance to win.
Well, in your judgment today as a practical politician, which one of these nominees would be the best vote-getter in Ohio?
In Ohio?
If nominated. I'm not speaking of the primary.
I think the Democratic candidate will be the best vote-getter in Ohio.
Well, but which one of these would be?
Well, I think any one of them could carry Ohio in 1960.
Well, who's
you see, the Republican candidacy is rather limited.
Well, which one do you think will be chosen by the Republicans?
Well, I have a feeling it'll be Nixon.
You have?
Yes, and he'll be a good candidate for them. I think he represents the Republican Party. He's a tough campaigner. He handles himself well in a campaign, and he's a rough, tough fighter.
Has Rockefeller got any following in Ohio among the...
I haven't noticed it yet. Nixon has been in Ohio many, many times. He was a keynote speaker at the Republican State Convention last time. He was a keynote speaker before. There's a lot of support among the rank-and-file Republican leader in Ohio, and I think he has the major part of the support there.
Do you think this new labor legislation will have any material effect on next year's election?
I don't believe so, no.
Do you favor the legislation which has passed both houses?
Generally, I would, of course, might want to change it in some degree, but generally, if I had to vote on the legislation, I would have voted for it.
You would, in spite of what's been said about it by some labor leaders?
Yes. I think that the legislation was needed. It was better to have some legislation than none.
Mr. Spivak.
Governor DeSalle, as you yourself have suggested, the years ahead are going to be very, very important, and it's going to be important to have a real leader in this country. Regardless of what his chances are for being elected, who in the Democratic Party do you think would make the ablest president? And regardless of whether he's going to run or not.
Well, we're extremely fortunate. I can think of 20 Democrats that would be able presidents. And who could lead this country well.
I'm not talking about the 20 who would be able. I'm talking about the one you thought. There are few people who know the Democratic top man better than you, Governor.
Well,
who do you think would be the ablest candidate, regardless of whether he can be elected or not?
You know, there's one thing that it's hard for us to judge until a man is in the presidency, just how he will rise to the obligations of that office. Men who have never in the past been measured in the size of the presidency have turned out to be rather able presidents. For example, Chester Arthur was pointed and scorned as a politician, yet when he was when he succeeded the presidency, he had better than a good record as presidency and lived up to the obligations that of that office.
Now, Governor,
I certainly am not in a position to say of all these men who've had fine backgrounds in public life, men who I've dealt with over the desk on many, many occasions, that I would say that one would more ably discharge the office than the other.
Now, Governor, you recently picked Vice President Nixon is the best Republican candidate for president. You didn't hesitate to pick the candidate for the Republicans.
Well,
why are you so coy about the Democratic candidate?
I'm not being coy about it, Mr. Spivak. Actually, Republicans have been narrowed to two. You hear talk about Nixon, you hear talk about Rockefeller. I said that Nixon would be the ablest Republican candidate of the two because of his familiarity with the problems and the fact that he's known to the nation. It's very easy to pick one out of two, but to try to pick one out of 20 is another question.
Well, how about picking one out of two? How about the difference between, say, Stevenson and Kennedy?
Make a wonderful ticket, really.
Stevenson.
In which order? In that order?
Either order. Either order.
Mr. Drummond.
Governor, if I may move away from politics for a moment, I assume that you're profoundly concerned with the steel strike. Ohio, if I understand correctly, is a state which, second to Pennsylvania, has the most labor affected. You've had experience in the problem of wage price inflation. I wondered why you didn't join with the other eight governors. What do you think should be done?
I was in Cleveland the day that wire went in, and in Cleveland on the same day, I said that I would join.
Now, you're urging a conference with the president see what the federal government should do. Right. Have you had a response yet, and how soon do you hope to meet with the president?
The only response that I've had is a response from Secretary of Labor Mitchell, in which he asked to have us submit the statistical information with reference to the impact on the strike in Ohio. I feel that people are more than statistics. We can talk about the people around at work. I think we can paint a much more graphic picture of conditions if we are face-to-face and are able to discuss it with the president. We have 100,000 steel workers. We have some supporting industries. And although at a cabinet meeting last Friday, I tried to find the impact, we have not as yet felt a tremendous impact. We can't discount the fact that there are 100,000 people out of work and that our relief roles in the steel-producing areas are on the increase.
Have you some views as to what the federal government could usefully do to help end the strike?
I think we're rapidly approaching 2 months in the age of this strike. It's going to be the longest steel strike that we've known. I think the time has come when we ought to begin to use all of the facilities. The Taft-Hartley Law, possibly. The president's position and influence in trying to bring the parties together. I don't think that we can continue forever and still not feel a tremendous impact that might actually be a catalyst towards a worsening economic conditions.
Secretary Mitchell said today that if the steel strike wasn't settled in a month, he would think the Taft-Hartley Law should be invoked. Does that seem soon enough to you, or rather delaying action?
Well, I'm afraid of delay. I'm afraid of delay because of the psychologies involved. I think today that people are rather discounting the impact of the steel strike because they feel that it's going to be settled from day to day. If it should continue for a longer period of time, the psychology might be the reverse, and people might begin to withdraw their spending or their planning and their programming. Right now, for example, in Ohio, we haven't felt the impact as far as our highway program is concerned. But our highway director says he doesn't know when it might happen. It might happen in matters of days. Once we get people out of work, out of construction work on highways because of lack of steel, it's much more difficult to get the program started again.
Mrs. Craig.
Governor, there's deep misgiving here about the exchange of visits between the president and the Soviet prime minister. Do you approve of the exchange?
Well, actually, I feel that the president ought to be in a position to have much clearer information on it than I have. I'm not alarmed by it. I had one experience. In 1949, I visited in Germany, and I'm visiting in Bochum, and I met a German industrialist who had just returned from the United States. This was his first trip to the United States. He was making speeches at Rotary Clubs and others in Germany. And in talking to him, he said this to me. He said, if Hitler had visited the United States and had seen the things I saw, we would have never had World War II. He said, in spite of the stories, in spite of pictures, you cannot realize the potential of the United States until you see it with your own eyes. I hope that maybe this could be a lesson to Khrushchev.
Many religious denominations are having services and evidences of mourning, and Cardinal Spellman has asked for prayers set aside a certain time on the day that he comes. Is anything being done in your state along that line?
Nothing that I'm aware of.
Specific.
I hope that people of Ohio pray daily for peace. And whether Khrushchev is here or whether he's in Moscow, peace ought to be our objective, and prayer certainly cannot hurt that objective.
Well, there's quite a problem as to how we should treat him. The question of should we stand silent and not applaud when he goes by. It's really, Congress, you know, is afraid to have him because they don't want to applaud him when he comes into the chamber. Do you think he should be invited to address Congress?
Well, he is the leader of a state. We don't agree with that philosophy. We don't agree with their history. We don't agree with their operation. But our objective is peace, world peace. If his visit can contribute to world peace and the saving of life, the saving of blood, the saving of the inflationary pressures that are now with us as a result of the Cold War, then I think those things that are courteous ought to be done. I know that there are many people in this country that I don't approve of. People who come into my office every day, people who represent interests that I think are inimical to the best interests of the state. I treat them with courtesy, and I listen to their story because I feel that as an elected official, this is part of my obligation. It doesn't mean that I agree. It doesn't mean that I will agree after he leaves. But at least I think people are entitled to a hearing. This is part of democracy. If in a democracy we're afraid to listen to the other fellow's point of view, then we don't have much of a democracy because it isn't a workable form of government.
Mr. Lindley.
Governor, you mentioned inflationary pressures, and you had some experience in dealing with them during the Korean War. What should we do to deal with inflation now that is not being done?
Well, actually, I think that we're going to have to, one of these days, re-examine the whole subject of inflation. Because what is inflationary to one segment of the economy is not necessarily inflationary to another. We have strongly organized groups in the United States today that are able to keep a pace of rising cost. We don't have the kind of inflation that we used to fear, the classical inflation where we had bushel baskets full of greenbacks going to the grocery store to buy a loaf of bread. Today we have a sort of a creeping inflation that is almost imperceptible, but the result is damaging over a period of years. Now, organized labor, industry, business are able to keep up with those rising costs. In this country today, we have a never-growing class of people, the people over 65 who retired on fixed incomes, and that inflation hurts, and hurts tremendously. We're going to have to try to devise some system of retirement programs that will keep a pace with increased costs, because I think we're going to have to admit one of these days that if we're to have full employment and a constant expanding economy, that we're not going to be able to do it without some slight increase in our cost of living, which will almost automatically result from our increasing standards of living.
Well, are you saying, Governor, that you've got to have wage increases every year or two?
Not necessarily. But you're never going to be able to pick one industry and say, this industry itself will be able to stop inflation. A wage increase in this particular industry is going to be inflationary and then permit every other industry to go ahead. There are 6, 7, 8, 9 major areas in this country where if some influence was exercised, we might be able to slow inflation up by hitting those major areas.
Well, isn't the steel industry one that's been setting a pattern for the rest of the country for
wage
increases along the line?
I'm not too sure whether the steel industry sets a pattern or follows a pattern. It's a case of the chicken and the egg. I don't know which comes first.
Do you think this strike should be settled by a wage increase or without a wage increase?
I don't know enough about the condition of the steel industry at this time. If you'd asked me that question in 1951, I could have told you what part of the cost of steel was involved in a wage increase, and I might have been able to give you an opinion. But 9 years removed from the study, I'm not in a position to
tell
you.
But if there is a wage increase in steel, then there'll be wage increases coming along afterward, maybe not this year, but
if there's not a wage increase in steel, there will be wage increases in other industry.
Mr. Spivak.
Governor, you recently had a tax increase of something like $330 million. How long since the state of Ohio has had a tax increase?
Well, I suppose the last major increase in tax in Ohio occurred in 1934 when the sales tax was adopted.
Well, that's almost a matter of 25 years.
Well,
what
right.
happened in this brief space of time since your election that made it necessary to increase taxes
to such a large degree? Nothing happened in the brief period of time since my election that made it necessary. The thing that happened over a period of years. During World War II, when the restrictions existed on materials and when manpower was scarce, the state of Ohio piled up a great deal of surplus. Revenues were high, and they were unable to spend it for institutions and highways and the services the state provided. Starting with 1947, from 1947 to 1958, Ohio lived on surplus, lived on its income, and lived on borrowed money. Now we're at the end of our resources as far as the savings is concerned. The borrowing capacity is pretty much exhausted. At least I felt it was. I didn't want to borrow anymore. And I decided Ohio should go on a pay-as-you-go basis.
Well, Governor, what about one of the newspapers, the Daily Reporter, says that you have a $186 million secret. You have $186 million that you haven't used.
That's a tremendous secret, isn't it?
Well, do you not have that?
No, we do not. The Daily Reporter, the man, I think his name is Palmer, Richard Palmer, who wrote that story, I'd like to invite him in with the best firm of auditors he can get, because I'd like to find it if it's there.
If we can come out and help you, Governor.
Yes.
At this point, I see that our time is running out, and I'm sorry that I must interrupt. Thank you very much, Governor DeSalle, for being with us.
Our thanks to Governor Michael V. DeSalle and members of the panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Meet the Press is produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. And now, if I may, a message of special importance this holiday weekend. How do automobile crashes happen? Often some little thing that takes the driver's mind off the wheel triggers the tragedy. Maybe it's happened to you. Another car refuses to let you pass, or some slowpoke burns you up. You feel like getting back at him. Well, forget it. Whether you're driving, your attitude can kill. And when another driver's stupidity or carelessness makes you fume, if you let anger take control of your car, you're headed for real trouble. Last year, 37,000 people died in traffic accidents. Many were killed by good drivers who